Hi, I'm George Sumner. I was formerly the Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Dallas. I'd like to tell you about a new book that's just come out with Living Church Books, a collection of my own writings over those 10 years. The book is called In Season and Out, The Reflections of a Bishop in a Time of Churning. The churning comes from a Zulu word, mfakane, which refers to a season of tumultuous conflict in Southern Africa. Our own tumultuous season of politics, epidemic, migration, suffering, and innovation are what I take up in my book, which also seeks a stable place for more theologically traditional Episcopalians, considers the imperative of mission, asks who we as Anglicans are really anyway, and poses theological questions for their own sake. There are convention addresses, pastoral letters, blog entries, reflections, and even a section of a catechism in the book. I hope you'll discover in it some grist for the mill and some sustenance for the journey. You can find your copy of In Season and Out, Volume 6 of Living Church Books at livingchurch.org under Products and then Books. Or click the link in the show notes of the most recent episode of the podcast.
Unlike evangelical impetus to become mic to share the gospel, we are saying come out, come into sacred space, come into something that is far different than anything that you are used to, and find anchor, find safety, find peace. And then from that, go back out into life, having connected with a transcendent loving God.
The Living Church. Serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878, welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. We all know it, the Episcopal Church is aging. The average age, I was just talking with someone about this the other day, and he told me that the average age of a parishioner is now in the mid-60s. And look, we love our older crowd. I love older Episcopalians. They are priceless. They keep the trains running. Look, you want an older Episcopal lady praying for you at all times. But where are the young people? This is a question that Episcopalians have been asking themselves now for many years. How do we reach them? What exactly are young people looking for when it comes to church? Well, at the risk of being glib, of course, they are looking for God, and by extension, the love of God's people in the church. And there is some good news, because the times are changing in terms of the race for cultural relevance, at least when it comes to ministry to young adults. And actually, I'd love to hear more about youth ministry trends as well, but that's a topic for another time. Waning, perhaps, are the days when churches feel pressure to change their style or their personality in order to appeal to younger generations. I mean, just look at the rad-trad movement in the Roman Catholic Church, or perhaps look at its gentler counterpart, the revival of young Catholic adults on fire for Jesus, who also have no animus against a Latin Mass. Because, in fact, what has worked for centuries to form God's people seems to just keep on working. Sacraments, sacred places, vestments and vessels, time-tested prayers, bread and wine, water, oil, and incense, loving community, and thank God, there is no sign at the portals, you must be 21 or up to enter. There's also an element of blessed enchantment or holy mystery in these ancient Christian rites and practices that's maybe given in a specially poignant way for a disenchanted world. I talk with someone today who doesn't try to solve this puzzle of why more young people aren't flocking to Episcopal churches, but who does want to point out some important pieces from his own 30-year experience as a campus minister. Today, we talk about his journey in ministry to young adults, blind spots and opportunities for the Episcopal Church specifically, what he sees in the spiritual hunger of students, what he has learned from evangelicals along the way, and how rootedness and tradition might give a real advantage when it is time for innovative mission. My guest today is the Reverend Alan Wakabayashi. Alan serves as the chaplain for the Episcopal Church at Princeton and as the Province 2 coordinator for young adult campus ministries. He has also been a campus minister with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and has pastored in a diversity of Episcopal, non-denom, and evangelical church settings. Last note for all of you about today's episode, here's a reminder to stay after our main segment for a bonus segment of the podcast. This is something new that we're trying out. We have a film review waiting for you after today's interview. Now, strap on your backpack and grab a cup of coffee. We're heading to campus, where we'll get an inside look at ministry and mission to young adults from one priest's perspective. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Alan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here, Amber.
Alan, I'd love to start out our conversation with hearing a bit of your personal story. How did life lead you here, and what was the journey?
This is not what I ever anticipated when I was younger. I was born and raised in Chicago, North Side, born into a Japanese American family. My dad was one of those who came out of the internment camps from the war. And so I was raised in a Japanese American Presbyterian Church, PCUSA, in the North Side of Chicago, just down the road from Wrigley Field. You know, church was started by a bunch of folks that came from the internment camps, and they could not find any place to worship at until historic Fourth Presbyterian Church in downtown Chicago gave them a little chapel space. And it took the senior pastor and an elder to just give the ultimatum. If you don't let their brothers and sisters, if you don't let them use our space, we're going to resign.
So this was basically racism is the reason that.
Oh, yeah. So that was the church's founding. They became Presbyterian out of gratitude to Fourth Pres. My mom was visiting her brother, who was the Japanese pastor, and my dad was coming to the English service for friendship. He was not a Christian. Met little old lady, matchmaker, played matchmaker. They got together. and as a result of the marriage, my dad came to faith soon into the, afterwards. And my dad and I were baptized the same day, as I was a baby. He was an adult. That was the beginnings. I was raised in that church, is much more evangelical than Presbyterian, I think. So evangelical world. When I went off to college, I went to a little dinky school called Milliken University. No one's heard of it. But InterVarsity Christian Fellowship was there, campus ministry. So I, after a little bit of a wayward venture into the fraternity life, partied my brains out for a little while, came back to faith. InterVarsity was the place where I started to really thrive and grow in faith. And so as a result, entered a master's program in world missions. But at the end of it, InterVarsity came calling to say, could I come back to Milliken to serve for a little while to see what happens? And that started the journey. I was on InterVarsity staff for 20 years full-time, another 7 part-time, and most of those, so little time at my undergrad, and then I went off to Northwestern back in Chicago, which for 13 years, I had the time of my life with InterVarsity, and then I felt a call to move to the pastor side of things and got a job near the University of Illinois, and I kept part-time hours with InterVarsity. Along the way, my wife became an Episcopalian, so she was, had a season where she needed a change for various reasons. And she found this Anglo-Catholic church in Chicago about 5 minutes from us, Church of the Atonement.
If anyone's listening from Church of the Atonement, shout out to you.
So my wife went and there's no turning back. She just fell in love. It met her right where she was, sacraments. She started going to all the midweek services with all the old ladies that would show up. And and I would join her for a while at services, and it was all so foreign. Anglo-Catholic churches, especially, all the movements, and I was lost.
But, I mean, they're more Catholic than Catholics. Yes, yes.
Yeah, we jumped in. And I think, that was the beginnings of me thinking, wow, there is so much significance in what the Episcopal Church does. It's not just empty ritual. There's so much meaning to things that, what you do and even built into the architecture. Years later, when I was a pastor in Urbana, Illinois, that heart things were churning. Like I think I need more and fuller expression of my Christian life. And I just started to read. And I think there's all this stuff that I started to read, things like, you know, Robert Weber's book, Evangelicals on the Canterbury Trail. You know, by that point, I was in charge of a church plant, a satellite church plant for our church. And I started double dipping. I'd go with my wife to her Episcopal church, go to the 8 o'clock Rite One service, hop in my car, drive back to my church to preach my sermon and to lead the little flock that we're trying to reach out to the community. I started introducing the BCP into our service. Got a little flack for that sometimes because it sounded too Catholic for some of them. It got to the point where I was going to both churches. It got to the place where it was just pretty clear, I think it's time to transition. Yeah, then I went through ordination, went through an Anglican year at Neshota House. Yeah, found my way to New Jersey for employment. And before I knew it, the job here at Princeton opened up. My bishop asked if I wanted to consider it. I go, for sure. And I got the job. So I've been here at Princeton 8 years. Love what I do. And, you know, I just really enjoy being on campus with these students.
I love hearing how all of those different things coalesced for you. I'm wondering whether there was anything significant about your own school experience or campus experience that you feel like really helps feed this passion that you have for campus ministry. What was it about your campus experience that now is like lighting you up for ministering to students?
I know for sure that my campus ministry experience was so foundational and critical to who I am today. The things that I learned and spiritual rhythms, rethinking my whole Christianity. I mean, so much happened in those 4 years. I look back and think that's exactly why campus ministry is so critical, that it is such a foundational season of people's lives. You've got these 4 years where they're not worrying about mortgages and, you know, families to feed. What an opportunity and the kinds of changes that can happen between freshman and senior year. It is extraordinary to me, still is.
I wonder, Alan, now if you could set the scene for us a little bit about campus ministry and the Episcopal Church, or maybe even a little more broadly, like pastoral ministry to Gen Zers and the Episcopal Church. What is that state of play? What are some top struggles and top opportunities that you've recognized in this area of ministry?
I could start with on the ground what I see, because not everybody does campus ministry this long. You know how some people are experts at like generational trends and, you know, this is what marks this generation. This is what, you know, I'm not great at that because I'm not thinking like that. I'm thinking like, okay, who's in front of me? Let's get to know this person. But I do see, you know, it's abundantly clear, you know, technology are issues. Students talk about AI. There is a cloud of anxiety because of the rest of the world right now. So whether there's financial realities that internships get cut because of affecting universities or whatever. And the partisan divide in our nation is being felt on campus as well, with that in a way that I did not see like in my generation of students, you know, as a student or students right now, their politics, some of them, it's a key part of their identity in a way that I'm not used to. And it's part of the whole national discussion where the partisan divide is just so bad and stark, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think this even affects, you've probably seen this also affect something like dating. I mean, I had a friend the other day, a guy messaged her on a dating app and said, essentially, oh, loved reading your profile. Too bad you're not MAGA.
Yeah, right?
And she was like, what? I guess thank you or what? So it's sort of like affecting their studies, affecting their identities, affecting like their love lives and their relationships, their families and all this. So yeah, it is a thing.
And Princeton, especially politics and public policy are one of the dominant like majors, and the School for Public Policy is huge here. So it's probably even more intensified at Princeton. Having said that, so those are things that, you know, I think, of course, people talk about, you know, students are all on their phones and things like that. I mean, yeah, I think that's their first language these days is technology in a way that it's not for me. And so dealing with some of that, and I think the campus ministry and the Episcopal Church at Princeton were fairly vibrant and healthy. But in the wider Episcopal Church landscape, my take is campus ministry is in very poor shape. It's just struggling. And part of the reality is that even, I'll preface this by saying I can't imagine what it's like to lead a whole denomination from the national level. But from underneath, what we're feeling is that the church leadership nationally has decided to reduce any kind of investment in ministry to young adults, the campus ministry and young adult ministry. All the funds that have been budgeted for us from General Convention seem to have been reallocated elsewhere. And so there's a few of us are being little troublemakers because we keep asking questions and saying, this is an unwise move of our church to reduce support investment in ministry to young adults, especially our, you know, our denomination, where over half of our church has reached the age of 65. And everybody's asking, how do we get to young people?
Well, yeah, where are the young people? I guess the flip side is, what opportunities do you see for pastoral ministry? Because you could still be with InterVarsity or you could still be with the evangelical world, but now you're specifically an Episcopal priest reaching out to students. What's special about being an Episcopal priest who's in campus ministry? Maybe someone's listening to you who has like $1 million in their pocket that they're like, oh, it's burning a hole in my pocket. Who can I give it to? It's like, reinvest in campus ministry for the Episcopal Church. So what would you say is that special opportunity we have?
Well, I think, you know, on one hand, I mean, this is part of who I am, right? I think there's a reason I left the evangelical world to become an Episcopal priest. I love being an Episcopal priest in Episcopal Church, what I understand to be the Anglican expression of the Christian life. I just think it's great. So, and at the same time too, it seems like this generation of students are just spiritually hungry. They don't necessarily connect, you know, affiliate with institutional things like the church, but they are asking the spiritual questions. They're hungry to find something. Sometimes they can't even articulate it. We see students, they wander in, we worship in the university's chapel, which is this amazing Gothic like cathedral space. It's just beautiful. I love it. And students are often in there by themselves throughout the week, during the day. Some maybe just need some quiet, some are praying, whatever. And so we've seen students who've found themselves coming to our services. And when I meet with them and talk to them, the common refrain is, Father Allen, I just sense peace here. When I'm in your service, I just feel peace. And they're looking for something. Some of them, you know, jump in, some get baptized and confirmed. Others don't, and you know, they disappear back into the campus life. But I think these students, and when I talk to our student leaders, I've asked repeatedly, like, what are conversations like? You know, and there's like, yeah, talking about spiritual things is just, it's not hard. We could talk about spiritual things with our friends. It's not hard. It's not so hard to say we go to church anymore. You know, like my generation, I was embarrassed to go to church, right? I'm going to a meeting or whatever, you know, like, it's not hard to say they go to church. In the students that we get love tradition, liturgy, smells and bells. And tradition is not a bad word. So we, you know, our tagline is ancient tradition, radical love. That's what marks us. And so using that word tradition is not a bad thing for these students. Some of them actually prefer older things. They want Rite One. They want King James English. We tend to lean high church, so.
Thank you.
For more than 80 years, the mission of St. Francis Ministries has been to provide healing and hope to children and families. Inspired by the past and rooted in faith, their vision is to see lives and systems transformed. But they can't do it alone. You can join them in their life-affirming ministry. St. Francis provides a wide array of services ranging from foster care and adoption to preventative and residential programs. Join their mission and help ensure children and youth receive the care they need to heal and rediscover hope. Join their mission and help families heal and regain wholeness. Join their mission and help heal the world one child at a time. They have lots of ways you can make a difference. You can explore them all at stfrancisministries.org/mission. That's St. Francis, S-A-I-N-T, francisministries.org/mission. It sounds to me like for these students, something about tradition is radical. So you're resonating with that. Can you say more about that? What do you think it is that's so radical for them and so like fresh for them about the ancient things and tradition? And what is it?
Whether they articulate it or not, there's an anchoring that they find in tradition. I grew up in an evangelical world where the movement felt like we are going to become like the world with the music, to make it comfortable so that anyone who wants to come will feel comfortable in the service. Our services, our liturgy looks nothing like what they're used to, right? I always, every Sunday, talk about the invitation to come step out of the life that is happening for you outside, come into sacred space, this chapel, the liturgy, and to connect with a transcendent loving God that is always present with us. So unlike an evangelical impetus to become like, to share the gospel, we are saying, come out, come into sacred space, come into something that is far different than anything that you are used to, and find anchor, find safety, find peace. And then from that, go back out into life, having connected with a transcendent and loving God, and live out the faith there. So I think there's something about the anchoredness, the differentness of what we offer that students are looking for. And, you know, granted, this is not every student. I mean, there's plenty of students that are going to the evangelical campus ministries, but the Roman Catholic ministry at Princeton is huge. It's humongous. And so in the same way, it's very old. They're experimenting with Latin masses and Gregorian chants and things like that. Our niche is that we are kind of the mainline option for church that is high church.
Yeah. Yeah. So connected with tradition, but not Roman Catholic.
Right. I remember Charlotte was early in my tenure. She wandered in because of a friend, and, you know, long story short, she became a Christian and we baptized her. But I asked her, like, Charlotte, did you ever consider going to, like, you know, the guitars and drums over at the evangelical world, you know, the campus ministry? And she goes, oh my gosh, no, Father Alan. And she looked up the chapel and goes, this is where I find God. And she just kind of said, this is where God feels like I will meet with God. And she was just so emphatic about that's why she came, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you observe in the article that you wrote that evangelical campus ministries are bursting at the seams, that they easily draw over 100 students to their gatherings. And obviously, you were with InterVarsity that has a lot of evangelical intersections for a long time. I'm curious, now that you're an Episcopal campus minister, is there anything that you still admire about evangelicals, or that you feel like, you know, you'd like to put a word to the wise for anyone listening, and you just want to say, like, look, what can we continue to learn? Where can we continue to be open or challenge our own preconceived notions, or even sometimes a little bit of the, like, high church snobbery that we can be tempted to go into? What would you say to that?
I just think the Episcopal Church in general, I think, could really benefit from some of the gifts of the evangelical world that I think I experienced. You know, I thought about this, like, you know, for one, I grew to love my Bible because of the evangelical world.
Yeah.
I studied it, you know, and I was as a small child, I was memorizing verses. I had to memorize the orders of the book of the Bible. That was a key part of my, you know, spiritual life, was to read and study my Bible. I come into the Episcopal Church. We hear lots of the Bible, but is it kind of normative for everybody in the pews to be reading and inwardly digesting and marking up their Bibles? No, not so much, right? And I've challenged my students, like, why is it the evangelicals have the corner of the market on this? Like, we should too, right? You know, I think part of my own journey is I feel like my Anglican frame has given me a wider lens from which to understand the Bible. Like, the interpretive lens has changed because of church tradition and the inheritance that we have from our church. But, and also too, there is just a entrepreneurial leadership, innovative spirit among evangelicals that I don't see in the Episcopal Church as much. You know, even my title, chaplain, I'm a chaplain at Princeton University. I use it because it's understood, but I don't think it's the right label, because I think chaplains conjures up images of just being reactive to what is present. So being here, I respond to the needs, pastoral needs. I speak, I'm the spokesman for God on campus. I don't think that's my job. I think my job is to missionally lead a community to live out the gospel in an appropriate contextual way to my world, to the campus. It's a very missional leader. I suspect the Episcopal Church is still from the inheritance of being kind of the establishment church. I think a lot of priests, they're managing the church. They're managing the services, the committees, making sure all the wheels of the machine are running. But how strategically are they thinking about being leading this missional gospel enterprise to engage the world? And, you know, I've been reading some books from mainline authors about revitalizing the church, like Dwight Shiley and other guys like that. And
tell me about it. And then I'd love to hear one that you'd especially recommend, and we'll include it in the show notes for people.
The two that there's one called Leading Faithful Innovation by Dwight Shiley and some others. Leading Faithful Innovation. And then there's another book called Leadership in a Shrinking Church by William Harrison. And these are books I just found, you know, I started reading them. But what I'm finding in them is, like, okay, this is what I'm reading is, my thought is, like, of course, this is what you do. But I'm realizing it is kind of the evangelical ethos of leadership and innovation that's being brought to bear and reframed in a mainline church world. The leadership in a shrinking church, I think, has some great things, but I look at it and, like, it's not just about leadership in a shrinking church. This is just healthy leadership.
Well, it occurs to me too, Alan, that rooted in the Anglican tradition might be a real benefit, because one of the risks of the entrepreneurial leadership model is that there can be a temptation to, like, go beyond your gifts or go beyond what God's actually calling you to do, taking on extra burdens of innovation, spinning your wheels, reinventing the wheel, overburdening your staff, trying to always be the charismatic guy or the charismatic woman or whatever. But I think some of that anxious energy that can come out of that comes from the lack of rootedness, or kind of the not being able to really have your roots deep down in the Christian tradition and feel confident about it. So if you already have that rootedness, I planted a pollinator garden in my yard. And last year it was not that impressive and I was concerned. So some gardening consultants came out and they said, it looks great, Amber. Year one, the roots go down. Year two, it starts to spread out a little bit. And then year three, it shoots up, and you won't believe how much it'll grow in year three. And so if your roots are already down, they're down so you can, like, spread out and shoot up and try stuff and innovate. So I've never thought about this before, but actually being rooted in an ancient liturgical tradition maybe should actually give people more freedom to be innovative and entrepreneurial as they feel called and as they're able to and try new stuff. What do you think about that?
I think that is really true. And I think there's something about how we do ministry, like here at Princeton and things, that some things we're not going to change. Like we, you know, our Sunday service, I met with our leaders just the other day to kind of assess how the year went and plan for the future, for the next year. Our Sunday night service, like, well, it's great. Then we can't change the liturgy. And, you know, there's things that are, we can tweak things, you know, but there wasn't a much to tweak. I have tradition and framework within which to operate in a way that sometimes I fear that evangelical world, the pastor feels like they're the star of the show, like it's them, right? And I've heard, you know, podcasts and leadership things that I was a little surprised because they were talking about how to grow your platform and grow from a $2,000 talk speaker to a $20,000 speaker. And I'm thinking, I don't think about those things. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, the celebrity pastor idea is so common and assumed in the evangelical world, partially out of this kind of, the sermon is so central to the service.
That's right.
I mean, I'm a part of it. You know, I think some of them like my sermons, I hope. But I'm a part of a bigger package.
Yeah, like there are things that the altar literally decenters you. I mean, when you're presiding, you're serving at the altar. And then when you're preaching, you're to the side of the altar. I mean, it's where we ask the Lord to come meet us, where he promises to come meet us. That is always at the center, and it is in stone. So that just, I would guess, gives a sense of security that could either lend itself to a kind of, you know, Anglican insouciance where it's like, yes, it's all been done. Therefore, I just now am sort of, you know, responding to things here and there and kind of keeping the wheels greased. But it could also lend itself to a confidence, a way that you don't have to spend your energy inventing yourself and reinventing the stuff that you can't reinvent because it's there for us. So then you can spend that energy thinking of other things that could be grown and could be nourished and deepened and people to reach out to and how to be more missional with the things that you're already given. Yeah, that just seems like such a neat opportunity to me.
I think I'm a very prayer book Episcopalian. Like, you know, if I recently was asked, could I help come up with a liturgy for some prayer thing? I'm like, we just use the prayer book.
Great. You just passed the Living Church test. If you hadn't said that, Alan, we would not have even aired this episode of the podcast. So I'm so glad you passed the test.
But, you know, and I do know there's Episcopalians out there that, you know, and church planters maybe that are experimenting with things. I just love staying in the prayer book, and that's what we use. So
yeah, that's great. Alan, I wonder, I know you said you're not a generational, you know, you're not obsessed with the generational habits and attributes, but I know that you've seen some generational attributes. People who are young adults right now, they are Gen Z or Gen Alpha. I wonder about one thing that you maybe really admire about young adults right now, or one stereotype bubble that you'd like to burst for us.
Well, when I thought about stereotypes, and I don't know how much of a stereotype this is anymore, but I do want to tell people the answer to reaching young adults is not guitars and drums and contemporary music and imitating the evangelical model of doing church. Because our students they just love liturgy, smells and bells, high church stuff. I even asked them, like, so what if we kind of tried enriching our worship as, you know, adding some resources and it was almost like this loud uniform. No. So
what?
So I think if there's a stereotype that younger people want, maybe it's because of some of the Episcopal camps that there's lots of, you know, more camping experiences with guitars and, you know, things like that. Maybe that's fine. But my experience with our students is they just love liturgy tradition, all the high church stuff. So in terms of gifts or opportunities with Gen Z, I just think they're amazing. So I think that Gen Z is an amazing group of young people. They are tech savvy, but I find a lot of them are much more pessimistic or cynical about the whole notion that the world is just progressing. Everything is progressing. I don't think that is in place anymore. I think Gen Z is recognizing that it may not be progressing, and like technology is not the answer to the world, answer to all our problems. Most of my students, they're very cynical and pessimistic about AI, although everybody's using it. Our campus ministry, we have made a really strong try at being an open umbrella, that the center of our ministry is Jesus, around the creeds is our faith expressed through the creeds. All the other things like the controversies around sexuality, gender, hopefully everybody can find a home with us. And so I think the generation, there's an opportunity on campus that if we help them navigate the across the line discussions politically, theologically, that they have the opportunity to be reconcilers out in the world. It's a hard balance, because I think when people look at ECP, the Episcopal Church of Princeton, we look like, we're very affirming, like whether you're straight, gay, trans, you can participate, serve at whatever level, acolyte, leadership team. But that's because we want everybody, we're not going to limit participation to anybody. We are not meant to try to take a stand about those issues as much as to take a stand that everybody is able to participate at whatever level. And that if you are conservative or traditional on some of these issues, you're welcome with us too, right? We're not trying to make this a boundary marker for involvement. It's a hard, complicated road, but that's a very strong conviction of ours, that we're not here to take a stand on these issues as much as to make sure everybody can find a place at whatever level of participation. But the potential is these students are rubbing shoulders as they get to know, someone who's conservative might get to know a trans person, or the relational dynamics, I think, is huge, that they will then go off and they will not be able to demonize people across the aisle because they have friends. I think there's a lot of hope with this generation if we can help them build these bridges now and have the relationships that can matter in the future. So
I'm curious that in these young adults who are coming to this ministry to be formed, other ways that you continue to nurture that ecumenical spirit while still providing good formation in Anglican distinctives, gifts, and practices. Does that question make sense?
Well, it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's got to start with me. I mean, it's got to start with the leadership that I'm so, sold out. I love our tradition. The more that I get to know and read writings throughout church history and get to know using the Book of Common Prayer, things like that, I'm sold. Like, this is what I hope students will adopt, right? We do have students who are picking up the daily office and things like that. Having said that, I think, to be honest, the mainline, I think it's when the mainline community starts to die that they become ecumenical. So Episcopal campus ministry shrivels up to almost nothing. It's like, oh, we better reach out to the ELCA or the Presbyterians, join forces, right?
The hidden blessings of shrinking numbers.
So, and they just want to shore up the numbers. And then I don't know how you do ministry in a way that can honor the different partners at play, but they do. And another person could probably share how that works. And our students are open to that. And I think as I speak respectfully about my colleagues across lines of denomination or religion, hopefully that models something. And as students raise opportunities, I'm always like, of course, let's think about how do we join with whatever, and when crisis hits, like when the October 7th happens with the killing of all those Jews on October 7th, both myself and the Catholic chaplain, we tried to show up in places with, and we invite our students to show up in places that would show support, right? I think it's more the ecumenical challenge is just, we're just too busy. So it's hard to connect until we really plan for it. And I do, the evangelicals, and I was them, right? So I understand the different degrees of interest in ecumenical discussions. Like some are not interested, like, that's okay, no thank you. Others are more, you know, there's a guy on campus, part of an evangelical ministry. He's also feeling like, oh, I'm enjoying this liturgical stuff. He comes to church sometimes with us, and he and I have great discussions, and he's wanting more ecumenical, like, dialogue across the line between the mainline and evangelical ministries as a way to enrich the life of students. And I've tried to broach that subject, but it's just kind of complicated to make all the logistics work for that. And so we have not yet been able to achieve a much more formal kind of ecumenical discussion across denominational lines.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you're making those attempts, though. I think that that's, I hope that that turns out to be worth it and to bear fruit in the future. Alan, can I ask, this is kind of a personal question, but if you wouldn't mind answering, when you find yourself praying for your students and praying for the campus ministry, what is something that you frequently find yourself praying for?
And this comes to kind of the discipleship and formation of our students. I mean, sometimes I'm praying for students I know that are seeking by name, like, you know, Lord, please open them up, help them to find new life with Jesus. But wider campus, I'm hoping more will find their way to us. So I pray about that. But when it comes to my students, the students involved, I think I'm praying for that they will increasingly take intentional steps to nurture that life of faith. Because I think in the main line, there's not this spirit. They already believe themselves to be Christians, but how intentionally they're making that central to life is another question, right? So that's what I pray for them, because we do have many, both cradle Episcopalians and students from other mainline denominations who join us.
I just have one more question for you, and that is, for a church that's near a college or university campus, if somebody's listening who's a parish priest today, or a bishop who has, you know, colleges, universities in their diocese, what is one thing that you would want them to keep in mind when a student walks through the doors of an Episcopal church?
One, I just don't think there's a silver bullet answer. I think it just comes to love these young adults, that come, you know, just love them, right? And love them. Don't try to use them. Don't try to recruit them to the choir. Don't try to recruit them to whatever. Love them. Get to know them. I think a lot of Gen Z would love intergenerational kind of connections. I mean, I think a lot of them, they're going to church, they're looking for their friends. So that's the bottom line. They're looking for other young adults. But when other young adults are not present, they would love to find parental or grandparents, like people that would, you know, take them out for a meal, get to know them. I do think the Episcopal Church Sunday services, especially, it's a whole culture thing. I've been to more churches where I was clearly the outsider, the newcomer, and no one talked to me, right? And I linger intentionally to see, what will this church do? And no one talked to me, you know, except maybe the priest, right? I went to another church. It was such a wonderful, I sat down early in the service, and before service started, already two different people come, hey, are you new? My name is Catherine. You know, what is your name, right? And then another woman sat down next to me, an older grandma. You know, she just exuded love. And, you know, we went to the altar together. She kind of warmly shook my hand after we did the Eucharist together. She led me down to coffee hour, introduced me to people. You know, it's like, you know, that church is like amazingly warm, where other churches, no one talked to me. No one invited me to coffee hour. And I even just stood around by myself and I'd look, and because I wanted to see what churches would do when I visit, right? I'm not wearing my collar either. So, you know, that happens more often than the other, the warmer church. So, and I think if young adults, they want to be seen, they want to be cared. I mean, they're just like human beings, like anybody else. So it's not specific to young adults. I think anybody walking in your doors who's new, just warmly exude the love of Jesus to them in a way that's appropriate, you know, to that context. I can't think of anything more specific.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I know that sometimes, especially white people, of which I am one, you know, we like our private space and our privacy. So we think that by not speaking to someone, maybe we're being polite because we're giving them space and we don't want to be rude. And so we're reticent, but reticence can create a feeling. I mean, if you're in your mind thinking, I'm being polite by not speaking to this person, all they know is someone's not speaking to them. So I think sometimes the sort of little introverted habits that we can have as Anglicans and Episcopalians can sometimes be lovely and polite and gracious, but sometimes can go beyond that into something that feels really unfriendly to people. So just like hook into that warmth and the human warmth and the desire to connect. You're right, can be so important.
If they want to be left alone, they'll let you know.
If they want to be left alone, they will run from you.
Exactly. So I think err in the direction of extending warmth.
That's right. I've been speaking today with the Reverend Alan Wakabayashi. He serves as the chaplain for the Episcopal Church at Princeton and as the Episcopal Church's Province 2 coordinator for young adult campus ministries. Alan, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Great, Amber. It was great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What's up, podcast listeners? Amber Noel here to invite you to a special deal on the Living Church's Fall Conference, Radiant Pages, Rediscovering the Bible. Right now, you can get 10% off your tickets with a special promo code TLCPOD10. We just want to thank you for being a listener to the podcast. Conference dates are September 24th to 26th, and in the lovely environs of All Souls Episcopal Church, Oklahoma City, we'll enjoy talks like Is the Old Testament Worth Reading? From Ellen Davis, and Lean into the Epistles of James and John with Wesley Hill. We'll tackle common questions about the Bible that you or your parishioners are surely asking, and even enjoy practical workshops on Bible reading for preachers and Lectio Divina. Ticket prices include all meals, including a final dinner together. Come meet new faces, greet old friends, and rediscover scripture with us. Go to livingchurch.org/events and use promo code TLCPOD10 for 10% off, or check out the link in the show notes of the most recent episode. Thanks for enjoying our main segment today with Alan Wakabayashi. To support these ongoing conversations about the Anglican Communion in podcast and print, go to livingchurch.org where you can read, explore, and even donate to our unique ministry. Today's bonus segment takes us into our Books and Culture Corner, where the Reverend David Beresford reviews the new film, A Great Awakening, about an unlikely friendship between Benjamin Franklin and itinerant preacher George Whitefield. David is a retired priest who lives in Wilmington, Delaware. He writes a weekly blog at davidberesford.net. We'll include a link to his blog in the show notes. You can also read his full review and all of our film, book, and culture reviews at livingchurch.org. We hope you enjoy the review.
A Great Awakening, directed by Joshua Enck, Sight and Sound Films. With the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence approaching, A Great Awakening shines a light on the religious revival that influenced that epochal event. The story is told through the friendship between Benjamin Franklin and the Reverend George Whitefield, the maverick and itinerant evangelist. The movie traces their separate paths, beginning in childhood, leading up to their eventual encounter in Philadelphia. Whitefield is born and raised in Gloucester, England, and later goes up to Oxford, where he experiences a religious conversion and commits his life to Christ. As an ordained deacon, he gains a reputation as a persuasive and charismatic preacher. He attracts large crowds and brings many to the Christian faith. Ben Franklin is the 10th son of Josiah, who gives Ben as a tithe to the Lord. God's hand is upon you, Josiah says to his son. Although the prophecy will come true, the God whom Franklin follows will not be the same as his father's. The independently minded Franklin is more interested in scientific and political inquiry than in conforming to any established religion. Whitfield enters early adulthood at a time when the Church of England has lost its evangelical fervor. Whitfield and the Wesleys see their mission as bringing the church back to life. In one scene, Whitfield dazzles an English congregation with his oratory. In the next, we see him at a mine, preaching the gospel while being pelted with lumps of coal. Such are his powers of persuasion that he turns the crowd around. In America, Whitfield's preaching is no less effective. Large crowds are roused by his inspiring sermons. In Philadelphia, a curious Ben Franklin is impressed by Whitfield's eloquence. When the two men meet in Franklin's print shop, they form a mutually beneficial partnership. Despite their differences, Franklin's deism rubs against Whitfield's more orthodox faith. Franklin's printing press will supply the popular demand for Whitfield's words. The title of the movie refers to the First Great Awakening, which was the birth of Methodism and the revival of faith within Anglicanism. Whitfield was its brightest star. It is estimated that he preached 18,000 times to 10 million people. The actor who plays him with convincing intensity is Jonathan Blair, whose good looks add to his appeal, although they do not match those of the real Whitfield. Franklin is played by John Paul Sneed, who bears a strong resemblance to the revered polymath and statesman. His performance, which subtly conveys Franklin's intelligence and wit, is central to the movie's success. Some of the best scenes depict the tension between the two men, especially when Franklin reproaches his friend for hypocrisy, drawing attention to Whitfield's use of slaves to maintain the operation of an orphanage. This raises a moral question that would be germane to any 250th anniversary discussion group. There are some minor quibbles, such as West Country folk speaking with Cockney accents. Imagine South Carolinians talking like New Yorkers. Ultimately, however, A Great Awakening is a movie that vividly recreates a key moment in the United States history. One question it raises is as pertinent today as it was then. Having sat through the Continental Congress sessions, Franklin stares at the half-sun carved into President George Washington's chair and asks, "Is the sun rising or setting?"
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, do you hate or love how priests are depicted in media? Do you love to hate it? When does Hollywood get it right? We've got more movie talk with film critic and writer Abby Olchesi when she and I exchange our top 5 depictions of clergy in film. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.